Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Saxophonist Bob Reynolds has toured extensively with John Mayer and has recorded and performed with everyone from Snarky Puppy to Willie Nelson to Usher. This week, he serves as guest conductor for the South Dakota All-State Jazz Band in Aberdeen, and he performs tonight with the JAS Quintet at the Icon Lounge in Sioux Falls. That's at 7 p.m. We caught up with Bob in Los Angeles. He was taking his lunch break from working on a broadcast of the television competition show The Voice. I asked him how he ended up getting to know local saxophonist Joel Shotwell and the members of the JAS Quintet. How did you end up hooking up with them, with the JAS Quintet?
Joel just kind of emailed me like months ago saying, hey, I see you're going to be here for the Allstate thing and would love to, you know, set up a show or something. And I've never been to South Dakota before, so I wouldn't have done that had he not, you know. He said, hey, I can put together the band for you and so on and so forth. So I haven't even, you know, that's just the sort of the adventures of a modern day sort of whatever you call what I do, you know, musician, right. It's like, you know, you rely on the kindness of strangers very often. And so he wanted to set it up, you know, and I agreed. And so I have no idea what I'm getting myself into. I was just like go into it with open ears and the best of intentions and hope for the best.
So you can just jump in with any group pretty much. Is that part of what you do? Is that quick
adjustment?
That is
part of what I do, yeah. Oh. Yeah, I mean, I do. It's like a lot of work and practice and training so that I can kind of, I don't want to say be a chameleon, because like on a thing like this, I'm showing up to be me, to do my thing, you know, whatever. But in terms of being able to play with anybody or any group of people and be adaptable to the situation, that's definitely that's a big part of it. Yeah. So they have my music. We're going to be playing my music and stuff like that. So I kind of like sent the music to the band ahead of time. But yeah, it's a bit nerve wracking, and yet like it also makes for some good, that kind of like good adrenaline for good music.
So how do you approach collaborating with someone that you don't know well then? How do you channel that adrenaline into something positive?
That's a great question. To some extent you're relying on a common language, at least your hope, you know, like all things being equal, any group of musicians that would be performing in a situation like this, like a small jazz setting, you know, whatever kind of however that manifests, you know, more straight ahead or more to the funk side or whatever the music tends to be like. If you're working with a group of musicians like that, there's a common language. So even though I haven't met the guys yet, you know, they, by the time I do and they've looked at the music and whatever, it's hopefully just a matter of a quick discussion and talking through, hey, this song goes like this, and you start at the top and you make a left turn here and you make a right turn there and I'll see you at the end, that kind of thing, you know. and then the magic part is sort of what happens in between, you know, the stuff you have, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's the jazz part, if you ask me, more than like a style or an era. That's what jazz is to me. It's like the ability to create spontaneously, have conversations with musicians in the moment. And you know, that makes it unique. It's not a thing where, hey, I've been rehearsing this with these exact guys for months and months, and we're going to come and we're going to deliver this product that we've polished off. No, it's basically like the musical equivalent of watching, you know, some people have a conversation live on stage, you know?
What defines a positive experience then? Are you going to know partway through this is going really well?
I'll probably know, you know, pretty fast, you know. It doesn't take more than a couple seconds to sort of assess, you know, a couple minutes at most to assess what's going on.
There are a lot of correlations to what you do to what we do on Midday, live conversations with everyone listening.
exactly.
I paused there for a minute because I was like, hey, he's talking about what I do in a little bit.
He just described my job. That's it. Yeah, live conversations with a lot of people listening. That's exactly it.
Do you find there's a lot of connection between jazz and other arts like that in the creative arts and in business and just similarities?
You know, more and more as I get older, I find that there's so many things are related and more than just like, yeah, business. Like the overlap between what it takes to be good and effective in speaking sort of the language of jazz and interacting in that way is very much like the same skill sets that would be needed in other things, like you just mentioned, what you do, or, you know, whether you're working with creative teams of people in other more traditional business settings, whatever. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of overlap. I see it more and more. Like, I'm always feeling like, oh gosh, that's exactly, you know, look over here. That's what I do. And what I do is what these people are doing over here. So there's definitely a lot of overlap, you know.
It would be hard to have a conversation with you without sort of name dropping all the people that you have collaborated with. But talk to me about some of those collaborations and what they mean to you now.
Well, you know, one of the parts of what I do besides, I get to play my own stuff and that's really important to me. But yeah, playing other people's music in different settings, you know, whether it's been the case of like John Mayer, or there's this band Snarky Puppy that I get to play with, or whether it's more like straight down the middle pop acts like Usher or Amos Lee, or there's a lot of different people. I love songs, so I love like doing what I do, especially when I was working with Mayer. Like, that was a dream come true for me in a way I didn't even realize at the time, but I grew up listening to Sting, and especially a certain era of Sting's music where he had a band that included the saxophonist Branford Marsalis. Mm-hmm. And I loved that. I just loved like that idea of, you know, of being able to find a way into a song to add something creative and colorful that's new to the song each time, but it's still supporting the song itself, meaning it's not like, okay, we're in the back half of this pop song, now look at me, I'm going to take a blazing saxophone solo. It's like, how can I add some valuable commentary to this, you know, to what's going on here? I mean, that might sound a little bit overly academic or something, mm-hmm. but it's just, in fact, it's the opposite. Hopefully at any given time, it's a lack of ego. And it's just like, how can I contribute? You know, just like, just the same way the bass player is and the guitar player is, like, it's all about making the song be what it needs to be. And when in a case like with John, he's the type of musician that is comfortable enough in his skill set that he can allow a lot of freedom in what he does. So he doesn't have to, the song doesn't have to go the same way every night. And in fact, you know, he doesn't want it to, or that would be boring. I mean, some songs do. Some are very like, hey, this is 3 minutes. We play this top to bottom and that's it. But then other songs would be 14 minutes long and they would, you know, expand and contract every night, depending on what was going on, you know. So that interaction, again, is like something really important to him, really important to me. So that was a real gift, you know, getting to work in his band in that way. A band like Snarky Puppy is interesting, too, because while it's made up of quote-unquote jazz-ish musicians, you know, improvisers, it's really a band of people who are in the same way committed to the song, you know, to the whole thing, the whole package. It's certainly not just about solos. And yet when the spotlight points on any member in that band, for them to take the song in a new direction, they can all deliver. And so that's really an electric experience to be a part of as a player. And also I think to witness as a listener, as an audience member.
Talk to me a little bit about Music Conservatory, and you went to the Berklee College of Music. Tell me about what that brought to your professional life and what you had to overcome to sort of let go of after you graduated.
Oh, that's great. Those are great questions. Well, I think looking back on it now, what it gave me was a tremendous foundation. I mean, I had a decent foundation coming into college. I was fortunate. I went to a performing arts high school in Jacksonville, Florida, which gave me a really good kind of running start. And I had a good teacher early on. But when I got to Berklee, the paces that I was put through there as a performance major. I mean, I chose what sounds like a ridiculous degree to get. Like, I have a paper degree that says like I have a bachelor's in music performance, which nobody has ever asked me for, and they never will, you know. But what's behind that degree is an incredible amount of work that I had to do for like that what's called juries and stuff. So, you know, each semester the requirements for what I had to prove I could do on the saxophone were basically a set of like athletic events that I never would have made myself do outside of that environment, you know? So I knew when I was there, I was like, this is the time where I'm going to go down this path because it's going to make me, you know, able to do things on this instrument that I wouldn't be able to do if somebody weren't sort of holding my hand and forcing me.
Right.
And I mean, I met a lot of great people, and I learned so. I mean, it was immersive and incredible on so many levels. But at the core, I got a really great foundation in playing the instrument, playing music, thinking about writing and learning about theory and all this stuff. The second part of your question, I did have to spend probably 5 years after graduating college to sort of shed a lot of the shackles that I mentally had left over from college. Like, you know, you spend so much time trying to please this instructor, please this teacher, you know, do what this teacher wants for this class and what this professor wants for that, that it definitely took me time to kind of, you know, I was in New York after college for about 8 or 9 years. And I would say the first 4 or 5 of them was me trying to figure out who I was amidst all of the things I'd been learning. You know, there's so much to learn and so many people to learn from and emulate and copy. And at some point you go, okay, but what's me? How do I feel music, you know? And stop trying to play to, you know, not for a grade or to impress somebody.
Did someone
like
help you figure out that you need to do that, or that did that just sort of start happening, or did you intentionally try to figure out who you were musically?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I can't say that any one person did. A lot of it was like in which situations I would place myself or where I would find myself. Like, you know, I feel like I should go to this jam session, but I don't really want to. I'd rather be playing with this singer-songwriter and this band. And, you know, it was a constant set of decisions I had to make, which were like just trying to be self-aware and going, where do I really want to be? What do I really want to be doing versus what do I think I should be doing and when, how do I think I should be playing? Because you get to a certain level of ability and, you know, it's like you can do things, you know, just because you can do things doesn't mean that you should, but there's like because coming out of a college like that, like I said, you know, you're always trying to sort of size yourself up and, you know, impress your peers and your professors and all that kind of stuff. So that can lead you down a road where you're making a certain kind of music that's, I don't want to say that it's not genuine, but in a way it's like, it's kind of like just saying, hey, look at me, I can do this. But that's very different from sort of like an inner burning desire to play a certain way or play a certain type of music. So it just took a lot of time playing with a lot of different bands, a lot of different settings and you know, just listening to myself, like internally, how do I feel about this situation and that situation?
You happy with the decisions that you've made so far?
I am. I am very, yes. I'm definitely, and it keeps getting better. So right. I am happy. Yeah.
You spent a lot of time on the East Coast. Now you're on the West Coast. Are there different influences to how you perform and compose as a musician from living on those two different geographic locations?
You have great questions, Lori.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You have great answers, Bob.
These are really, really great questions. I do. And there's a different, like as a player, when I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, I was a little bit concerned that I was going to sort of lose some of my edge, so to speak, leaving New York. What I found was when I went back to perform in New York after having lived in L.A. for a little while, it was the first time, like I played a club in New York that I would play frequently when I lived there. And I always felt like I had one eye to the back of that club, wondering who's going to walk in, you know, who am I, like I need to be on my A game because so-and-so might walk in and I want to impress them with my playing. Mm-hmm. And after leaving New York, living out here and then going back there, I didn't have that feeling at all. And I remember noticing like, wow, I just played a set that was like the most sincere I've ever played. And I didn't care at all who was in the back of the room. And that was a real interesting shift for me. And I also have found that, no, I haven't lost, at least I don't think, or I hope not, haven't lost any sort of edge to my playing. I've just, I can continue to sort of get comfortable, I think, with how I approach music. But there's most definitely a different set of like players and influences on the East Coast and West Coast. Although there also now is a nice overlap happening. There's a lot of guys from New York, you know, bouncing back and forth between LA. The LA scene is really, really blossomed and I love it out here. But I do enjoy going back to New York a couple times a year to sort of, you know, revisit my friends and players there, because that's a, there's an electricity there that is just unique to that location and the type of players there.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to my conversation with saxophonist Bob Reynolds. He plays tonight with the JAS Quintet at the Icon Lounge in Sioux Falls. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to my conversation with musician Bob Reynolds. He's serving as guest conductor for the South Dakota All-State Jazz Band this weekend, and he's playing with the JAS Quintet tonight in Sioux Falls. So when you come to South Dakota and you come into that room with students, they're going to be, doing what they're going to be struggling with their own sincerity because they're going to care very much that you're in the room listening to you. How do you help students overcome their desire to please you?
I've been there, so I know that. And the funny thing is, I don't remember when I was in that situation. I never had anybody who came into any event as a clinician or whatnot. I never had anybody speak to that. I never remember one single person who was like the guest clinician at anything ever say something like, you know, talk about them being nervous or uncomfortable or how, what, like, whereas I'm happy to address that stuff, you know? So I hope to put, you know, them at ease in by just to saying like, I was where you are. I still deal with this, you know, that's something I talk a lot about. There's also another thing, which is like, at that age, they're not supposed to be where, I mean, they're just not supposed to be where I am yet. You know what I mean? They're at a different part of the journey. So where they should be right now is, and what I like to kind of, you know, shed light on is the stuff that they really need to be focusing on and working on right now. And if you don't do that kind of hard, diligent work at that stage, then you won't have the chance later on to make decisions. One of my favorite takeaways from college was I had a professor who, in a class one time about jazz improvisation, he said to a piano player, he said, listen, he was trying to tell the piano player that, you know, he needed to be able to do this one musical thing. And the piano player said, that's not for pianos. Like, you know, maybe if you're a trombone player. And that my teacher said, listen, would you rather be a drummer who can swing and chooses not to, or a drummer who can't swing and chooses not to? And I just love that because that, for me, has become like a lifelong motto. It's like I want to be able to absorb as much information and do as much as possible, but then choose not to use it all the time. So to these kids, I want to show them the right path of like what to be focusing on, who to be listening to, how they should be practicing, what the right way to develop is. But you got to just, they should be emulating people right now. They should be trying to absorb as many players who've gone before them as possible. You know, this is the time to do it. This is not, when you're in high school, is not the time to be like finding your own voice, so to speak. Hmm. You know, because you can't, that's like saying, that's kind of like the equivalent of saying like, well, I'm going to go to Italy and I'm just going to start making up my language because I want to have my own voice. Right. Well, nobody's going to understand you if you don't speak Italian, you know, that's yeah, it's ridiculous. So you can't skip that part.
Talk a little bit about how you put thing, how you use video and technology. I was looking at some of your videos online. You had one about memorizing more than 20 Snarky Puppy songs in 1 week, where you broke it all down to this ridiculously helpful level of organization. And then you share that with other musicians. And I think, you know, artists could look at that. Writers could look at that. How do you use technology, video, and your website to sort of put together your own thoughts and then communicate with other musicians and your audience?
You know, there's so many tools and stuff available, and I can't help. I've always liked to share. I mean, I feel like the way that I learned, so much of what I learned was not through formal lessons, but through things that were just sort of musicians I was lucky enough to be around who, you know, it was the moments that they weren't teaching moments. It was somebody showing me a recording. It was somebody just mentioning offhand how they did something. Those were the things that were like, for me, oftentimes with the aha moments, you know. And I just try my best to bundle my aha moments together in whatever way, whatever medium seems to, you know, fit right. Like, lately, I've been doing this video blog, whatever you call it, a vlog, about 50 days in at this point, where I've just been putting all this stuff together every day. Literally every day on YouTube, I've posted a new one. And they're just kind of mixing together, you know, what's going on, what may be happening in my career during the day, like, you know, whether it's a recording session or it's a gig or it's this, that, and the other, with, you know, maybe answering a question or two and some insights. I mean, I just just trying to kind of like share the helpful stuff, share the good stuff. Because I grew up, I was really fortunate to have some really wonderful players around me in my, you know, my early years. And I think I took it for granted for a long time that like, oh, everybody got that. Mm-hmm. And what I realized more and more is, no, everybody did not get that. And so stuff that I would take for granted, you know, other people just had no idea about, and it can be really game-changing stuff. So I'm just trying to help, you know, pass it along.
You talk about fear a little bit in one of those video blogs, fear masquerading as things more eloquent. How do you address fear as an artist?
Well, it sort of, you know, it depends on the situation. You know, I mean, there's different types of it that manifest depending on what's going on, you know, like, there's like, oh, like today I got to do this thing and we're on national TV. Like that would make some people nervous, but like nobody's looking at me. I'm just here supporting the singer that everybody's actually looking at. You could have nerves about that. And that's a very different thing than like, okay, now you're at my show and this is my music and my tune. Like now that's a different sort of spotlight that's on me. There's just different gradations of it. I just try to, I'm a very like fundamentals oriented musician in terms of like how I practice and what I do in my approach. So I try to always just be, you know, if I'm taking care of business the way I need to on my instrument and, you know, I'm in shape, you know, ready to go in any tempo and any key and any part of the horn, then I just let the situation dictate what it should be. And I do my best to just get out of the way, you know, just take a breath and just be there for right now. And remind myself that like, nope, you know, it's easier said than done, but it's like nobody ever is kind of like analyzing you as critically as you are yourself. Hmm. So
talk about conveying emotion a little bit through music. Is that challenging for you? Does that come naturally? Is it something that you've studied?
I think it comes, how can I phrase this? I think it's always wanted to come naturally. Hmm. And I have had to fight to let it over time. I think that's what I've recognized more and more as, you know, again, as I kind of get older is like, it's not that I'm like, oh wow, I learned this new skill of how to like convey emotion through music or the saxophone. It's like, oh no, I was just too embarrassed early on to do that. Mm-hmm. Like it felt too, you know, So the irony is like the more skills that I've acquired, you know, the more I've learned, the more stuff I can do as an instrumentalist or whatever, as a jazz musician. I don't want to say necessarily that the less I choose to do, but again, that there's power in choosing and there's power in space and there's power in not playing. And it's those I've come to really enjoy those spaces, and those spaces are the terrifying ones for most, especially young musicians. So like the classic thing is for young musicians to overplay, and it's because they're terrified of the silence. You know, maybe that if they don't play, that means they're going to get lost, or people think they're lost, or they don't, you know, there's all this like head game stuff. But if you're just constantly playing, then, you know, you kind of like don't have to address that. But it's a scarier thing to kind of just, you know, say less or say more, excuse me, but with love. So in terms of just conveying emotion, I try my best to never bring an agenda to a musical situation. I never want to show up and say, oh, here's all this stuff I've been practicing and now I'm going to demonstrate it for you. Yeah. I hate that kind of music. Music should happen right then and there in the moment. And it's a result and a byproduct of that time, that moment, that place, those musicians, that audience, it's made from that. And if you believe that and you're true to that, like great things can happen. And sure, there'll be messy parts and mistakes and whatnot, but that's not the point. And I just try to, I try my best to like sing through the horn. I mean, as much as possible. That's my model is like, I should be able to, the horn should just be a vehicle for, that's my voice. I don't sing. I'm not a singer, but I try to through the saxophone.
Hmm. What do you want to do that you haven't done yet?
Oh man, so many things. Like there's like so many albums I've always, I want to make, and they're just for me. I just don't want to deal with the actual making of them and the whole process, but I just creatively would love to do them. There's a long list of people I still want to play with. I hope I get to work with Pat Metheny someday before I'm done. There's a big list still of things.
Is there a role for compromise in being a musician at your level, or is the main task to avoid compromising and stick to that true self we've been talking about?
Well, what do you mean compromising? Meaning,
like, how do you handle the notion of compromise? Do you just sort of, is it a constant challenge to stay true to, you know, hey, I don't like that, I'm not going to do it? Or do you come up with situations where you think, well, I really ought to, you know, step into an area that I don't love as much?
Gotcha.
For a particular reason.
Yeah. So for me, it's just been about finding where I can contribute, where can I contribute something that is the best that I have to offer. So I guess what I mean is, like, I've come to find out I'm a pretty good teacher, and I also really love doing it. But in a certain way. So the way that I teach is I have my own, like, online school, but I don't teach at a school because I don't want to teach at a school and deal with the bureaucracy of, you know, like, some situation like that. And I don't want to play all the woodwind instruments. I'm not the guy that you should call if you need somebody to play piccolo and flute and bassoon and clarinet, because I don't have enough time left in my life to get to where I want to get to on the saxophone, on the tenor saxophone, let alone the others.
Yeah.
And so I've got so much work left to do with that. I don't want to waste any time doing on, like, other instruments that I just don't even, I have no love for, you know? So I try to say yes to the things that I love and enjoy and I'm really, like, I know that that I'm good at, or I'm unique at, and say no to the things that, like, somebody else, plenty of other people could do, you know. I'm trying not to just, like, it takes practice, but not just say yes to everything and chase every possible thing, you know. It's a lesson I kind of am always learning, but you know, that's life.
I can't think of a better way to end it than that. Bob Reynolds, it has been a privilege to talk to you today, and I really look forward to following you and seeing what you do next.
Cool. Thank you, Lori. I appreciate it.
And in advance, welcome to South Dakota. I hope you love it. We're going to close out the show with music from Bob Reynolds. He joins the JAS Quintet on stage tonight at 7 p.m. Central at the Icon Lounge in Sioux Falls. The song you're about to hear is called Closer to You.